I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
Thanks, Ken, and I'm glad to be here.
Last week, we learned more about how to avoid having sleepless nights, which was step three in your investment formula. Now, let's take a deeper look into the next step, negotiating the best deal. A few weeks ago, you gave our listeners several tips on how to get started. Perhaps you could expand on that a little?
You know, Ken, negotiation is such a deep and a wide subject. There's a lot of things to cover, and some of them you need to go into in quite a deal of detail. But whether you're looking to purchase a property or buy a new car or simply negotiate a raise at work in your salary, everybody is a negotiator. And the reality is that everything is negotiable. And you just have to realize that you have to have this as a skill. And although you may be learning it from a property perspective, it translates into every aspect of your life. Just buying a new television is an exercise that you can use the skills as a negotiator. So what we need to look at is that there are three key components or elements in negotiation. The first is information, the second is time, and the third is power. Now, when it comes to information, I mean, there's an old saying, to be forewarned is forearmed, and that's never truer than in a negotiation. And people hesitate because they know they need the information, but they don't know how to go about getting it. And what I find interesting is that before a negotiation begins, that's the time to seek the information you need to learn more about the other side's aspirations and needs. And whether you talk with the vendor direct, which is probably less likely, more likely with their agent, invariably they will be happy to share that information with you because they, more than anyone else, want to do the deal. And so you have to ask these questions as part of the normal conversation. I mean, if you show that you're genuine interest in them as people, they feel much more comfortable at giving you the information you need. And with a little practice, you'll find it's not hard to get a lot of questions answered with straight answers. So, I mean, the things you need to know is, and as I said, it comes up in the course of conversation, it's things like, why are the vendors selling? It doesn't have to be a direct, aggressive question. It just is a simple, by the way, question. I mean, do they have family or personal commitments that they've got to meet? Are they moving interstate or overseas? Has there been a change in their business? Maybe they have some settlements falling due. I mean, if you're a professional investor or a developer, it may be that you've done a project, it's getting close to the end, out of the 10 or 12 commercial units, there's only two left and you're trying to wrap them up. So maybe you're prepared to do a better deal just to close the books on that project and move on to the next one. Does the vendor have a cash problem or a cash flow problem? And sometimes when there are some properties that you purchase on what's called a sale and leaseback, where the vendor is, having sold the property, will stay on as the tenant. And it's important you understand whether they, as a company, have a cash flow problem, because it may be that they wish to release a large lump of cash, happy to enter into a three-year lease with multiple options, the implication being that they're there for a long time. But their thinking is, well, look, let's clear all our debts now. If things don't work out after 2 years, then our total exposure is only for another year's rent. So that's important information you need to know going into that deal. And taking that to its extreme, are they, as vendors, being forced to sell? Now, it doesn't necessarily have to be a mortgagee's auction to be forced to sell, but just with a little bit of probing and eliciting of answers, you're able to get the information that you need. You see, what you want to know going into a negotiation are the real limits of the other side. And, you know, I've got to say that in all my times of negotiating over the years, I've never seen my agenda or my client's agenda going into a negotiation as being identical as the other parties. Sure, there may be a number of common items on the two agendas, but they will always be ordered in a different ranking as far as importance is concerned. And so you need to identify, A, what's on their agenda, and B, what is important as far as they're concerned. Because you need to be able to trade there with them and give them the least important items on your agenda, which I find invariably end up being at the top of the other party's agenda. So it's important that you establish this at the outset, because it's not something that will be forthcoming as the negotiation unfolds. And really, you've got to think of negotiating as just getting what you want, but at the same time giving the other party what they want. And, you know, one of the most formidable weapons you have as a professional negotiator is silence. Now, most people hate silence and will attempt to fill it with information, which is exactly what you want. So you need to train yourself to be able to ask a question, the answer to which will invariably commit the other party to what you want them to agree to. And then you simply be quiet. And you don't have to fear it. I mean, you have to ask yourself, if everything goes wrong, will my life end in this negotiation? And once you have that attitude going into a deal where you can walk away from the deal and feel no remorse, you will find that the power of silence is quite extraordinary.
You often talked about the need to treat negotiating as a process rather than an event. Why is that so important?
Yeah, you're right. Most people consider negotiation to be an event, whereas it's actually a process that happens over a period of time. I remember back in the mid-2000s, I read a book by David Lax and James Sabinius, and it was called 3D Negotiation: Powerful Tools to Change the Game in Your Most Important Deals. Now, there's been a lot written about negotiation, as you can understand, over the years, and they range from quick fix solutions through to things that are highly theoretical. And probably this book would be more on the theoretical side, so I'm not recommending you rush off and buy it and read it. But one of the key things they said was that by establishing and maintaining multiple perspectives in the bargaining process, you will be a far more successful negotiator. Now, I think you've heard me talk and you would have read my blogs, and I say that it's important to have a number of balloons in the air at any one time when you're negotiating, because once you get down to just one item, it's someone wins, someone loses. But when you've got multiple items in the air, you have the ability to trade. And that is probably the essence of their book. But what they're really saying is that most negotiators are really one-dimensional, and that's because they adopt that win-lose position. They're more interested in trying to maximise their share of the pie, whereas what you need to do is have a win-win philosophy. And in that case, your principal aim is to make the pie bigger so everyone can get what they want by adopting a problem-solving attitude. Now, you won't find this in their book, but what I've created is a little graphic which explains the 3D process as far as I can glean from what they were saying. And it just captures it in a simple graphic, as I said, which I think will make things a lot clearer. Now, what I'll do, Ken, is I'll give you a copy of that. We can put it on up under the podcast today. So if people go to propertybriefings.com and go to today's podcast, they'll be able to view it and download it from there. But what it explains with the 3D, a one-dimensional negotiator has their sole focus on the tactics at the table. That's all they're interested in. It's slick, canned, repetitive, and their sole focus is just creaming the deal. So it's certainly one-dimensional. Now, a two-dimensional negotiator is more concerned with the design of the deal. In other words, they want to uncover the interests of the other party, work out how they can add value. As I said, some of your low-hung concessions in your list, I mean, you might have seven items on the list and it's the bottom three we're talking about. They may well be items one, two or three on the other side. And it's by uncovering those interests and timelines and constraints of the other side that you're able to design the deal better. Now, the 3D negotiator has his focus on the setup. In other words, you scope the sequence, you work out the process going forward. In other words, you're doing a lot of prep work, and this is part of gathering information and structuring the deal in your mind before you even enter into or meet up with the other parties on a face-to-face basis. The 3D dimension negotiator has all three levels, starting with the setup, then moving into the deal design, and it's only when all that's in place do they go to the table. And so at the table, they're not adopting a win-lose attitude. It's very much a win-win attitude because they already know what's on the agenda of the other side, and they can explain to them how by modifying something slightly, they can actually give them such and such, which may well be greater and exceed the expectations of the other side of what they were going to take away from the table. So it enables you to have a negotiation where you get exactly what you want. You give the other party what they want, and everyone feels good about it as they walk away from the table. So it's a fascinating process. And maybe let me just give you a quick example of something that probably highlights best the concept of not making it an event. Let's assume that you are about to help one of your children or grandchildren buy their first car. And you've seen an ad in the paper for a second-hand car. And you went out to this older couple who were obviously decided that driving is past them, and it's a well-kept car, and you've driven it around the block and you feel it's fine. And the advertised price was $4,500. And the car's in good shape. It's probably not overpriced. And you sit down around the kitchen table and they ask you, well, what do you think? Now, you say, well, you think, I've been to one of Chris's sessions on negotiating, better lowball them, see what the response is, and we'll take it from there. So your opening proposal is $1,500. Now, the husband turns to the wife and says, look, dear, we were really expecting a bit more than that. What do you think? What should we do? And she, without missing a beat, says, look, dear, it's up to you, but I think we should take it. Now, what crosses your mind straight away? Two things. The first thought is, gee, I've probably paid too much. If they accepted that straight away, maybe I should have offered less. Now, what's the second thought? And that is, what's wrong with the car? I mean, why would you accept it that quickly if there wasn't something wrong? And so you have that nagging feeling in your heart that somehow this deal happened too quickly. And there are many occasions over the years where I have had to actually slow deals down because I've seen both parties with an over-eagerness to do the deal. And I know from experience that if you don't feel you have extracted the best deal you can, even though the other party is happy with what you've offered, you feel bad about it. And quite often the deal will fall apart because you can imagine if you're talking about a property deal, you not only have to negotiate the deal, you actually also need to document it. And a lot can fall apart from a handshake through to the actual documentation and signing of the contract. So this concept of being an event is fallacious. You need to consider it as a process that may take 1, 2, 3, 4 days at least, but it could well take 2 or 3 weeks. And so don't be concerned if it is protracted, because actually, once you do the deal, it's more likely to stick.
It sounds as though time plays a significant role when you embark on a negotiation.
Yeah, time changes all things. I mean, don't be surprised when you receive an initial rejection to your proposal, because no is a reaction, it's not a position. With the passage of sufficient time and repeated effort on your part, every no can be transformed into a maybe and perhaps eventually a yes. So sometimes what you need to do is to, if you're in a position to close the deal quickly because you've got your finance in order, that's good and you can often do deals. But more often than not, negotiations need a lot of patience. I think I mentioned that, you know, deadlines are often fictitious. Quite often they've been created by negotiation, and therefore they can be extended. But shifts in position are made predominantly towards the end of a negotiation, not at the beginning, because the parties are trying to feel each other out. What you'll find is that 80% of the concessions are made in the last 20% of the time available. So what you need to do is find out the other side's deadlines and then hold off making your concessions until you enter that 20% period at the very end. And so time can be very powerful, and power moves from one party to the other as deadlines approach.
How would you like to tie today's chat together?
I know I explained before the three dimensions of a negotiation, but look, nothing's never that simple. There are really no neat boundaries between these three dimensions. It gives you a framework to hang things off, but you'll find they're fuzzy from experience, and sometimes you'll move more quickly from one level to another. So really, the purpose of providing that is really just to help raise your focus beyond being just a single-dimensional negotiator, where your prime focus is on tactics at the table, because you need to be smarter than that. You need to effectively control the entire stage upon which the negotiation is taking place. And it's these skills and knowledge that you need to identify and gain and make part of your toolkit as a professional and become a professional negotiator, so that you can then stand strong as a professional investor.
Thank you. I enjoyed all that, as I'm sure our listeners did too. So, Chris, until next week?
Yeah, I look forward to it.